The measure of the state's success is that the word anarchy frightens people, while the word state does not. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. Today I am joined by John Bush. He is a self-described radical activist. He's also an entrepreneur and father of two based in Austin, Texas. He owns the Brave Botanicals, which offers high-quality kratom and CBD, and founded the Freedom Cell Network, a mutual aid society intended to help individuals secure their inherent sovereignty. Mr. Bush, thank you for joining me. Where is the best place for people to find the collection of your work?
They can find my podcast, and there's links to all the different projects I work on at livefreenow.show.
Got it. Today, we are going to go over the New Libertarian Manifesto by Samuel Edward Konkin III. So we're on the same page, Mr. Bush. What is libertarianism?
Libertarianism is a political philosophy. Its foundational principle, I would say, is the non-aggression principle. And that actually, I guess the foundational principle would be self-ownership. And from there, you can deduce that we have control over our lives, we have free will, and it's wrong to aggress upon another. Voluntary exchange and free markets come into play. And so, yeah, it's essentially a political philosophy that aims to consistently apply the non-aggression principle. And of course, the logical end of that would be voluntarism and anarchism, because a minarchist government, which many libertarians identify as minarchists, that is inconsistent with the non-aggression principle. So that's where we get to good old anarchism.
Part one of the New Libertarian Manifesto is titled Our Condition, Statism. What is statism?
Statism is a political philosophy as well that believes we ought to organize ourselves according to an institution that has a geographical monopoly on the initiation of violence, an institution that can force people to do things against their will, where one group of people is in power and everyone else is subject to that group. And it's a nasty religion, and I believe it's one of the biggest hindrances to human flourishing in this world, historically and in modern days.
Part two is agorism, our goal. What is agorism?
Agorism is revolutionary market anarchism. It is more than a philosophy. It's a strategy that was outlined by Samuel Edward Konkin III in his seminal piece, The New Libertarian Manifesto. I like to say that agorism is all about, rather than competing within the system, it's about competing with the system. And the means to the end of agorism or achieving a free society is the counter-economy, counter-economics, which broadly can be defined as any action, activity, thought that evades or defies the state. More specifically, it deals with black and gray markets, black markets being those activities or services or goods that are expressly prohibited by the state, gray market activities being those activities, goods, or services that this government requires permission in order to engage in those activities. And it's all about building up the agora, the open economy of free people participating with one another, so we can hopefully replace the state as a means of organizing society.
Some of the agorism you are engaged in includes the Freedom Cell Network, a mutual aid society intended to help individuals secure their inherent sovereignty. Can you please expand on the Freedom Cell Network?
Yeah, freedom cells are essentially small groups of people, approximately eight people, working together for mutual aid, mutual defense, and achieving common goals. We choose the number eight because there's been research done by Bob Podolsky, who many people know in the Liberty Movement. He wrote the book Flourish, but he worked with this guy named John David Garcia, and they found that eight people is the optimal number of people for maximum creativity. And so what we encourage with the Freedom Cell Network is creating and building, criticizing through creation. And so you get together with eight close folks. We call this an inner cadre. Could be seven, could be six, could be nine, could be 10. And you work together on common goals. And then you link up with other small groups to form a larger group we call a middle cadre. Maybe it's just stretched across a city. And then eventually these middle cadre groups in Central Texas, for example, we link up with the folks in Dallas-Fort Worth, and we link up with the folks in Houston, Texas, and we form a meta cadre that spans across the Texas region or the South region. It was an idea I came up with in 2014. I haven't been a political activist for several years. I was becoming disillusioned. I learned about agorism in 2009 and really started trying to apply it. And I came to realize there's a lot of people that very much value liberty and freedom, but they still participate in state institutions. And I kind of honed in on the fact that people are afraid, rightfully so, to opt out. So I was like, well, what do we need in order to make people feel more comfortable opting out of the state, trying something new, creating a new society, essentially? And I thought strength in numbers would be that. So we started work on the Freedom Cell Network. Derek Brose of the Conscious Resistance Network really resonated with him. He took the idea and ran with it, spread it into a global movement. There was about 1,000 people before COVID-19 popped off last year. And then because of the government's response to COVID-19, and the technocracy accelerating, the movement grew to over 10,000 people. And then when we did the Greater Reset, now it's grown to around 19,000 people globally that are participating in this decentralized peer-to-peer mutual aid society called the Freedom Cell Network.
That's great. I remember in like March of last year when, you know, the whole thing was, we told you morons that we need a very big state or else we can't deal with things like a virus. I can't believe you idiots didn't appreciate government. And it was only like a few months after where the states not only lied about everything you should do, they stopped people from getting tested because of FDA regulations and occupational licensure. And now, because of the lockdowns between Newsom and then Cuomo's deathbed scandal in New York City, between Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, now people are more inclined to accept our ideas and embrace the actual my body, my choice principle of libertarianism and self-ownership. You mentioned the importance of freedom cells and getting people together. I remember Sam Konkin, I don't remember if it's this or the Agorist Primer, where he talks about how lowering the speed limit from 65 to 55 for truckers created this solidarity amongst the truckers where they would start radio stations and communicate with each other to watch out for, you know, stops where there's tickets being given by, you know, officers trying to hide in certain places to get you. So just the fact that solidarity and you sort of get this social proof of it's not one guy who just thinks there shouldn't be a government and hates, you know, traffic lights. Dinesh D'Souza described an anarchist as someone who's like chopping down a stop sign because he can't allow the state to do anything. When you really realize it's just a bunch of people who advocate the principles of voluntarism instead of violence, and it's not one or two, it's a lot of people who, you know, don't look too crazy, then that sort of social proof makes it so much more likely for people to embrace our ideas. You are also the owner of Brave Botanicals. What is Brave Botanicals?
Yeah, Brave Botanicals is a business that offers high-quality plant medicine, among them kratom, CBD, Delta-8 THC. We also have colloidal silver and some other stuff. A lot of people aren't familiar with kratom. It's a member of the coffee family, although it has no caffeine. It's made from the powderized leaves of the kratom evergreen tree. This is what it looks like right here. It helps with stress, anxiety, the green varieties especially. And then there's red varieties. They're a little bit darker. They help with pain, relaxation. A lot of people take them instead of prescription pain medicine. A lot of people use kratom to get off of opioid dependency or addiction, even get off of heroin. My girlfriend used kratom to stop taking Adderall and to quit drinking. She's been a year sober now. There's also white varieties. They help with energy, focus, motivation. And I really appreciate being in this line of work as an agorist, as an activist, because the government really does not like kratom. Your audience is probably familiar with the revolving door phenomenon and the regulatory protectionism that comes from the Food and Drug Administration. And they have been working to try to discredit and ban kratom. In 2016, the DEA was about to add it to Schedule 1, but a bunch of people rose up and I'm not a big fan of political activism, but in this instance, people rose up and fought back, and the state, the U.S. representatives and the senators sent a letter to the DEA, and they're like, you can't ban this. A lot of people are benefiting from it. So it was not banned. And yeah, a lot of people really benefit from it. The federal government, through this Operation Choke Point program, it's a great use case for agorism and counter economics and getting scrappy with entrepreneurship, which agorism has a whole lot to do with. I like how that gets pointed out. So they banned the Operation Choke Point made it hard for credit card companies to do business with firearms dealers, head shops, Kratom, CBD, adult toy stores. These are some of my favorite industries here, right? And so the credit card companies, because they're pressured by the banks, which are pressured by the federal government, they won't do credit card with Kratom. So we have to do e-check, which is a great workaround. We do cryptocurrency, of course. People can mail a check. You know, it's been a difficult industry because the government doesn't like it, but because the government doesn't like it and it helps so many people, that definitely fuels my passion to help people get this amazing plant remedy. If people want to try it in your audience, they can actually try an ounce for free. We'll actually send them this right here. You just pay $5 shipping and handling. We'll send you an ounce. Normally retails for $15. It'll last you like 2 weeks to a month. And then you can get a good understanding of what it's like. We also do CBD and Delta 8 THC, another kind of agorist loophole. Because the Delta 8 THC comes from the hemp plant, not from a marijuana plant, air quotes for the podcast audience. It has less than 0.3% THC, Delta 9 THC, but it has Delta 8 THC, which still gets you high. We do these gummies as well. They're really sweet, 25 milligram blueberry gummies. So it's totally legal federally. Can't ship it to 11 states, though. Those 11 states are legal cannabis states, but they're like, you can only get it from a licensed vendor within the state. So, yeah, it's great doing entrepreneurship. I wanted to mention earlier, Sal the Agorist, he always points out that agorism essentially is entrepreneurship. The two it's the same thing, one and the same. So it feels good to be an entrepreneur. It feels good to help people with these products, and it feels good to defy the state knowing that they don't like it.
Yeah, Sal runs a great website, 3D Printer Go Burr, with 3Rs.com, where you can purchase a variety of three-dimensional printers. What are some of the best ways you could introduce someone into actually partaking in agorism, whether it's in purchasing cryptocurrency and they have no clue where to start, or actually trading with vendors and people in their local or even distant community online in order to operate without the violence of statism?
Sure. One thing that I liked that Konkin pointed out in the New Libertarian Manifesto, he encouraged people to bring libertarianism to agorists, folks that were already engaged in the counter economy and didn't know it, like your local marijuana dealer, cannabis dealer. And then he also encouraged us to bring counter economics and agorism to the existing libertarian. So I think that's a great space to go in, a great place to start to grow the agora, because counter economists, folks that are evading the state, you know, prostitutes, people that are cheating on their taxes, or I wouldn't say cheating on their taxes, people that are keeping their own money and property, folks that are selling illicit goods, you know, they already have a disdain for the state and they already have caution and fear of the state. So they are ripe for recruitment into the philosophy of libertarianism. Just the same, libertarians already don't like the state and understand its mechanisms and how it's harmful to human liberty and human flourishing. So the great path and approach to get there is through agorism and counter-economics, not through political activism. So I would encourage people to try to focus there. But then at the same token, just about everybody evades or defies the state in their daily lives, right? Whether it's speeding, whether it's getting creative with your write-offs on your taxes, whether it's cryptocurrency that you don't claim to the man. So I would encourage people to start small and to kind of recognize that in many ways, they're already participating in the counter economy. They're already agorists. They just don't know it. And then kind of encourage them and push them to go a little further. And then join the Freedom Cell Network, freedomcells.org, where you can link up with a bunch of other agorists, thousands of other agorists, and you might feel a little more secure in pursuing this path, which does come with certain risks.
And people can still appreciate the ideas of the counter economy. If you ever, I mean, pretty much any exchange of money that one person makes to another, you should let the IRS know about. I mean, at least mention it in, you know, some portion of your taxes if you want to make sure you're obeying the law. But it's so ridiculous to do so that you don't bother doing it. And you can rightly see they have no entitlement to any property you justly acquire. Garage sales, I see them all the time. They're not doing anything like, you know, making sure to claim that. Mm-hmm. People who you know, hire landscapers off the books, people who sometimes pay in PayPal. And I know that PayPal's not exactly an agorist institution or anything, but it's a heck of a lot easier than, you know, signing up with the state so you can issue W-4s to people. Part three is counter-economics, our means. Konkin says, counter-economics provides immediate gratification for those who abandon statist restraint. Libertarianism rewards the practitioner who follows it with more self-liberation and personal fulfillment than any alternative yet conceived. I know you mentioned counter-economics beforehand. Is there anything else on counter-economics you'd like the audience to understand?
I just think it's important that we try to be as consistent as possible. Konkin says that it's the consistent application of the philosophy of liberty that will bring about the libertarian society. And so for years now, I've encouraged people to take stock in that consistency and to be self-aware and conscious of the activities that they engage in and the institutions that they participate in. And just be aware, like, oh, okay, I just looked at my checkbook and I just realized that I do banking with Chase Manhattan Bank, right? The Rockefellers. Maybe that's not the best avenue. Perhaps I could be a little more consistent banking with a smaller bank or a credit union, or better yet, avoiding the bank altogether using cryptocurrency and cash, right? So I think in order to grow the counter economy, it's important for us to all be conscious and aware of the activities that we do that are in the white market that could be in the black or gray market and allow us to have more freedom and encourage the creation of a bigger agora.
Part four is revolution, our strategy. What is Konkin's case for revolution and what does he mean by it?
Well, one thing I like is when everybody hears the word revolution, they often think about taking up arms against the government, which in many instances, in most instances, is a losing battle. And then even if it ends up being a winner, oftentimes the revolution, the goal is to overtake the existing state institution. And then, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. That's what we saw with the American Revolution experience. So I think it's important for us to hone in on a peaceful evolution rather than a revolution. And that's exactly what Konkin was talking about. He even points out the futility in going toe-to-toe using violence against the state. And so the revolution that Konkin is talking about is the growing of the agora, of the counter-economy, slowly but surely through different density phases, right? He points out the different phase zero, phase one, phase two. And that's essentially what we're trying to do with the Freedom Cell Network. And then I like how he points out that once we have enough people, we can essentially start hiring private security forces to defend us from private criminals and public criminals alike. That's something that I'd like to see the Freedom Cell Network, once we reach a good number and there's enough density in a given geographic area, the folks that are participating can come together, pool their resources. They can use defense on their own, but they could also hire professional defense services to defend them. And then as we grow the economy, the counter economy, as we grow the agora, we can create an environment where we feel more comfortable opting out 110%. There's already people that I know and people that I come across at festivals and here in Central Texas that are like true agorists. Derek Bros comes to mind. He's a pretty bold guy. He's living it 110%. And so I think as we have more people, we become more emboldened, and then we can engage in this agorist revolution, which is just a bunch of people cooperating together peacefully and opting out of the state institution.
Part five, action, our tactics. What tactics can be used to fight the state? I get that there's a lot of overlap here, but as far as the final part of the New Libertarian Manifesto, he says part five is action, and this needs to be our tactics rather than sort of, I think, what does he call them? Library libertarians. He says we need to engage in action. What does that mean?
Well, he talks about the movement of the libertarian left, right? And they were working and organizing as an opposition to the Libertarian Party. I love the footnotes of the libertarian history in the New Libertarian Manifesto. There's a lot of really rich stuff there, and the role that Rothbard played and the role that the Coctopus played. It's really fascinating. And a lot of that stuff's still at play today. But I think organizing getting together with your fellow agorists is absolutely critical. So, you know, you could read the New Libertarian Manifesto. You could theorize about the principles and how great and grand it would be. Or you can go out and live that philosophy. And in order to do so more safely and more effectively, we need to organize with other people. So I think one of the best actions that we can take, it's kind of like a, you know, a preemptive action. It helps to make the transition from statism, because even libertarians that object to statism in many instances, myself included, are still part of the state institution or still voluntarily, even though there's coercion, right? Until the gun's in the room, we're still voluntarily making a choice to participate in some of these institutions. So in order to ease that transition, to essentially mitigate some of the risk involved with opting out of the state and becoming a true agorist, I think there's immense strength in numbers. So he called it the movement of libertarian left. We call it freedom cells. It's just a different iteration of an agorist cadre. So I think getting involved with your fellow agorists and showing yourself, just putting yourself out there and finding the other people and then working together, I think is a great tactic that we can all utilize.
On page 48, Konkin mentions the importance of the division of labor. He doesn't give us a definition, so I just want to go from Dr. Robert P. Murphy. Instead of each person doing all of the work, creating what he needs and wants, dividing the labor amongst all of us into specialties is clearly superior by increasing the productivity of labor. Then people trade their surpluses with each other in the market economy. No trade barriers anywhere should be allowed to limit this division of labor. Any further points on why it's important for us to understand and embrace the division of labor?
I think that people have different talents and people have different activities and services that they enjoy. So in order to be more successful in life and have a happier life, it's important that we hone in on those things. And then again, going back to the strength in numbers, there's so many different services and goods that people acquire that they go to the general public to find. If we spent more time focused on who in our community and our network might be able to provide those services off the books, black market, gray market type activities, but even white market stuff. I think that would help a whole lot to create our own economy and to try to opt out. And in many ways, this is something that we've talked about and speculated on and done, but the state and the technocracy, more specifically, this new technocratic rule that's coming into play in the wake of COVID-19, where there's scientific dictatorships and technologies playing a big role, right? The fourth industrial revolution, part of the Great Reset. It's kind of forcing our hand. There's these COVID immunity passports where you have to have a green light, meaning you've had COVID before or you've taken the vaccine in order to travel. In Great Britain, and in Australia and other places, they're saying you can't even go into supermarkets and grocery stores and public squares until you have this green light. So now it's more important than ever that we focus our effort on finding those that are specialized and that can offer goods and services that we are in need of within our own community. And then we can say, you know what, to hell with the supermarket. We have our own decentralized, resilient food network. We have our own farmer's market that we build. We have our own open air market, literally an agora that we go to. We have a plumber. We have the electrician. We have the defense guys. We have the arbitrators. So we don't even want to participate with your community. We're doing our own thing.
Now, do you think it's almost kind of necessary to engage in some sort of anarcho-Zionism where people have to move to a physical geographical area so they can engage in, you know, sort of self-defense tactics against aggressors, public or private, so they can sort of grow food without having to, you know, send it through, you know, FedEx, UPS, or even USPS, is people being physically close together, for example, the Free State Project in New Hampshire, something vital for the New Libertarian Manifesto to come to fruition? Or are those just imaginary barriers that can be easily worked around?
Well, that's a great question. And there's a lot of thought that goes into that. And I do think that geographic proximity is absolutely critical. Now, as technology advances, there is more and more stuff that can be done in the digital space. This is also part of the World Economic Forum's Great Reset. They want to create this fourth industrial revolution where folks remain in a virtual world. They remain at home. All the COVID-19 measures were in large part a means to this end. And I think that that isn't good for humanity, right? I mean, there's a paradox because the internet and technology and social media, it simultaneously kind of creates this this faux human relationship that lacks authenticity and that connection, a handshake, for example, the energy that's in a room, you know, at a conference or a libertarian festival. If anyone in your audience has been to a Liberty Festival or a Liberty Conference, you kind of leave buzzing for the next week or two because of that energy that was there. That's hard to recreate when you're on a Zoom call, for example. But again, the paradox is that it also simultaneously connects people that never would have been connected before, or it would have been difficult staying in touch with them if all you had to rely on was a phone call or snail mail, for example. But when it comes to safety and opting out and agorism specifically, I do think that there's definitely immense benefit and value being in close geographic proximity. And the way that I see it playing out, I'm also a big fan of intentional community and eco-villages. And one thing, and a lot of folks involved in the Freedom Cell Network, which, by the way, people can join at freedomcells.org. Freedomcells.org, you sign up, you register, you list your skills, you put an address. Don't put your home address, put maybe a park or a coffee shop down the street, but then you can see people in your area. And a lot of people are meeting up, and a lot of people are like, wow, there's someone in my neighborhood, literally three blocks away. Maybe I'll go knock on their door and see if they want to go on a walk or something. But that geographic proximity is critical. And what I would like to see is libertarians, agorists get outside of the city. So I understand the city is a great place for commerce and many people are rooted in the city and they have jobs and careers in the city. But the smart cities is where a lot of this technocracy is going to be brought to fruition. And there's going to be a lot of real one hellish dystopian surveillance control society that's being built in every major city pretty much in the world, especially in the United States. And so what I would like to see is folks band together, leave the smart cities and build our own intentional communities that are in line with the earth, that are eco places, right? Not like carbon neutral, so on and so forth. But when you engage in permaculture and regenerative agriculture, you necessarily have more harmony with the environment, which is a good thing, right? So I would like us to see, I would like to see people leave the city, go in on property together, form these intentional communities and eco-villages, and then link up the intentional communities and eco-villages in a confederation of sorts where we establish mutual defense compacts, where we establish trade routes, and where we help one another. And we're like existing outside of the city in a given region. And then maybe there's a cluster of a dozen intentional communities or eco-villages that are all linked up in close proximity. And then we then link up with another cluster that's in the neighboring state or the neighboring geographic region and so on and so forth. And we have this sprawling mycelium network of human communities that are supporting and defending one another. And I think that's a great practical path to get from here to there.
If someone sort of is looking at this and saying, well, it looks nice and I love the ideas and I would love to associate with other voluntarists. However, it seems extremely risky. For example, if I'm caught cheating and not letting the badge wearers know all of the money that I acquired in the last 365 days, they'll cage me and then I'll have even less freedom. So what do you say to someone who says, screw agorism, it's too risky?
You know, it's not for everyone. It all just depends on your values. So my risk assessment, the amount of risk I was willing to take changed whenever I had children. For example, I have two kids, 7 and 9. And before I had kids, I was like in the cop's face, filming the police. We started this peaceful streets group. We did a lot of police accountability. I was more bold. And then I got arrested when my daughter was 1 and like put in jail, and that wasn't good. And that her mom was like freaked out and stressful, and it was not a good situation. I was kind of like, maybe I should pull back from that. But that's not to say that I abandoned agorism altogether. I just switched my tactics. So that's something that people need to weigh on a personal level. But one thing that I've noticed lately, there's the old saying, it's better to have a gun and not to need it than to need a gun and not to have it, right? It also applies to cryptocurrency. The masses before were like, it's too risky to get involved with cryptocurrency. Well, now maybe it's too risky not to get involved with cryptocurrency because of the inflation that's taking place. Just the same, it's better to have an agorist community or to be involved in the Freedom Cell Network and not need it than to need it because the state comes knocking at your door, even though you try to be a good boy, a good person, and to not have that community. And at the end of the day, even if you try to be a good citizen, air quotes, the government still harms you and messes with you. You slip up on your 1040, for example, and they still come after you. So it's all about having some skin in the game and how bad you really want it. Do we want to just have this philosophical circle jerk? Do we want to go to the Libertarian Party convention and like have people run for office, rarely ever getting elected and actually bringing about more freedom for people's lives? Or do we want to actually see these ideas come to fruition within our lifetime, hopefully, or at least within the next generation? And that's just something that people need to weigh. But at the end of the day, you know, the government's really overwhelmed is one thing that I've realized, knock on wood. But like this whole quote unquote insurrection, again, with the air quotes, freaking Trump, the MAGA community, they literally just stormed the freaking Capitol building, which is supposed to be one of the most secure places on earth. All this hundreds of billions of dollars of terror money getting put into outfitting and retrofitting and all sorts of stuff. And then all these crazy patriot conservatives just busted into the Capitol building. Like, I think the Department of Homeland Security has their hands full with all these militia types and all these hardcore right-wing extremists, air quotes. You know, the agorists that are going and pulling their kids out of public school and investing in cryptocurrencies and trying to build communities. Like, that's, I think that we're going to be okay.
Yeah. You know, I remember being a little shocked that they got into the Capitol building. And then I saw a number of, I don't mean to make this about the event, but it matters. But
yeah, it was fascinating.
There were a number of videos that showed the police almost totally standing down and letting the rioters in, something that Whitney Webb and Derek Brose, I remember talking about how, by the way, they think of how much they would benefit from some sort of election kind of civil war. You think it's Biden, you think it's Trump. No, we're not doing this. The state's going to come and usher in a tyranny, and you're going to like it too, because we've had you in government schools getting to recognize our legitimacy this whole time. I know you've done a lot of research into 9/11. You think January 6th was, it of course is totally exaggerated, the of it. So that is obvious that they've tried to milk this for everything. It wasn't. It was a nothing burger, if anything. Do you see any sort of red flags that this was a false flag?
Yeah. So, yeah, I've been a 9/11 truth guy since 2002. That's actually what got me into activism tenfold. So there's these two schools of thought with 9/11. There was made it happen on purpose, and there was let it happen on purpose. The made it happen was like the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition, criminal elements within the Central Intelligence Agency and within British intelligence and Mossad were behind it, right? And then there was let it happen. Condoleezza Rice in the 9/11 Commission testified that there was this report, Bin Laden determined to attack within the United States, you know, so on. Then they let it happen in order to be a precursor problem reaction solution to invade the Middle East, to at least have public support for invading the Middle East, and to roll out the John Ward of the Defense Authorization Act, the Patriot Act, expand the powers of the NSA, so on and so forth. So the same analysis can be applied to what happened at the Capitol. Did they make it happen or did they let it happen? Some people, like Bros, would say the whole thing is a made it happen. And in fact, Trump played the role of stoking that division, right? Another problem reaction solution. I think Trump's authentic, total authoritarian, you know, but I do think that he's a genuine outsider. It's not this huge, deep level play. But I do think they let it happen on purpose. I do think that there was a stand down order, just like with 9/11. I do think that it was done in order to expand the Department of Homeland Security domestic anti-terrorism apparatus in order to expand surveillance. And I think that the MAGA Make America Great movement was played in large part. I do think at the same time it frightened the hell out of the politicians and the political class that happened and that people were so outraged. But I do think that it was an effort to not only neuter the MAGA movement and discredit them, but more importantly for the state, to create the pretext for more authoritarian measures, specifically with the Department of Homeland Security. The same thing happened with the Oklahoma City bombing false flag, which was, I think, 1993 or 1994. It was the Department of Justice, and the ATF had a big role in it. It was Janet Reno had a big role in it. Eric Holder played a role in it as well. He was later, you know, moved up to attorney general under Obama. Whenever you cover up these things and you engage in these really treacherous acts, they know that they can trust you, so they advance you in your career. But the Oklahoma City bombing happened. It neutered and discredited the militia movement, which was growing in the wake of the Bill Clinton administration, which was very globalist, New World Order stuff. And then they rolled out some anti-terror legislation that created the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which brought the FBI into local communities participating with local law enforcement. That was later expanded when the fusion centers of the Department of Homeland Security, with me and my ex-wife, went and did a lot of activism surrounding that in 2009, 2010. That was rolled out after 9/11, where they discredited the Muslim community and they ushered in the Patriot Act and all that stuff, Department of Homeland Security. And then again, the same play with the Capitol building. They discredited the MAGA country, MAGA movement, and then they rolled out all of these new draconian measures. So yeah, it's a classic tactic. I'm surprised more people don't see through it.
This is just one I like asking. Who are you holding more responsible for alternative tech not getting more attention and people staying on big tech? Big tech and the CEOs, or our content subscribers who won't take 2 minutes to go create an alternative account?
Well, I mean, I still have a YouTube channel, and it gets more play than my Odyssey and stuff. Derek Bros, I always bring him up. We do a lot of work together, but he's real consistent with that. And he's like, I don't even think we should use the YouTube. And I got booted from YouTube, so to hell with him. But, you know, I after Derek's channel got pulled and a lot of people were getting pulled in this whole big tech thing, which started with Alex Jones, of course. That was the first one. It's like, first they came for Alex Jones and I did nothing. Then they came for the truthers and I did nothing. Then they came for me. You know, there's this great dichotomy. There's an essay by Albert J. Nock called Isaiah's Job. And he talks about the Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, who was tasked with spreading the gospel. And he went out to spread the gospel and he came back to the Lord disillusioned. He's like, nobody's listening to me, trying to preach the gospel and nobody wants to hear it. And the Lord was like, don't get disillusioned. They're not your audience. You're not tasked with waking up the masses. You're tasked with finding the remnant, those people that will pick up the pieces of society when it collapses and rebuild anew, right? And in this essay, he describes the masses as the large lot of people that just go along to get along, incapable of comprehending complex principles like the word of Jesus, or in our case, the philosophy of liberty or decentralization, or the idea that we can exist and have order without a state institution. And so a lot of libertarians focus on, we need to wake up the masses and we need to recruit the masses. And like the Libertarian Party, we need to get 50% plus one of the vote, of the voting public. Maybe we should be more conservative and tone down our message so we can recruit more people. But at the end of the day, the masses never change the course of history. It's the remnant that do, right? The agorists in our case. And so I think that even though there's still so many people on Facebook and YouTube and the big tech platforms, what really matters are the people that recognize the alternatives. And I think if we can simply shift our focus to that of education, still engage in the education, because what the education does is it picks off pieces, people on the fringes of the masses, right? Left or right. The people that are like, I think that government's okay, but I'm really, really skeptical. And then we're like putting out content about New Libertarian Manifesto or the FDA being a fraud. And they're like, oh, wow. And then we bring them into the remnant. But really, I think the emphasis, and if we shift our focus onto organizing the remnant, I think there's already enough of us here. This is something I realized in 2007, 2008 after the Ron Paul campaign. I don't know how many votes he got. It was like 1 million plus or something pretty substantial. And I was like, holy crap, there's a significant number of people that already think like this. What if we all just organize ourselves and opt it out? And so I think that's what comes to mind when I think about big tech censorship and stuff. It's like the masses aren't going to do much. They're not going to come along with us. They're just going to go along to get along. Many libertarians are in that boat as well. What really matters are those that are ready and willing to build something better.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's great to stay on YouTube and even the big tech platform, so long as your heart's not in it and you're just walking on eggshells waiting to get canned. Yeah. But the point is to diversify your portfolio and make sure you're subbed to all your favorite content creators on Library Odyssey, Minds, BitChute, Archive.org, and just so, you know, it's not so devastating. Of course, we all remember when Derek's channel was canceled and he was very devastated. Well, he wouldn't have been if all of his subscribers had taken a couple minutes to make a free account on Odyssey.com and subscribe to him there. He'd just say, okay, well, I'll just start using this. But, I mean, people can't... And that's why it's so funny when people are like, well, the way to make things change is to, you know, talk to people, lobby Congress, write laws, hold them accountable. That takes an incredible amount of work for years on end. Why don't you take 2 minutes and subscribe on freedomcells.org and on odyssey.com? Oh, well, I'm so busy right now. I don't have enough time. Oh, please stop lying. Is there anything I missed in the New Libertarian Manifesto or any contributions of Samuel Edward Konkin III that you'd like people to know about?
I really like the section where he talks about the phases and the transition, and I think it's good to kind of think about that and help to manifest that, the phase zero, zero-density agri-society, low-density agri-society. I think we're in phase one, and maybe we're going to start bridging into phase two. And, you know, it's like we brought up earlier, like you got to put some skin in the game. If people really want this, they have to make a decision that they are going to actively choose to engage in the counter economy, to pay more attention to their activities and the energy, where they give their energy. And, you know, I often think, and this is something that Sal brings up also, like, wow, you know, if Konkin was alive today, he'd be like, holy shit, I never thought this was going to grow into this crazy movement and network with everybody preaching my work and people actually doing it, right? And then cryptocurrency comes to fruition. That's not something Konkin anticipated. And it really is a technology that can accelerate the manifestation of the Agora. And we got the Freedom Cell Network and all sorts of decentralized communities and the folks up at the Free State Project. They have a hardcore agorist cadre. They even have underground clubs like an Alongside Night, you know? So I think we really have come a long way. And at the end of the day, it's only just beginning.
Excellent. Mr. Bush, thank you so much for your time. I want to finish with a quote from Rothbard, who, while critical of the manifesto, it is his birthday, so we're going to appreciate his work. The glory of the human race is the uniqueness of each individual. The fact that every person, though similar in many ways to others, possesses a completely individuated personality of his own. It is the fact that these unique personalities need freedom for their full development that constitutes one of the major arguments for a free society. Mr. Bush, thank you so much for your time, and thank you to everyone for watching. Keith Knight, don't tread on anyone.